Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, from sea to shining sea, from coast to coast, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And to all our friends all over the world who are streaming our program and podcasting it and everything else, thanks so much for joining us today. Seems that the Prime Minister of Iraq and the Vice President of Iraq are saying, yeah, that 16-month timetable, that looks like a pretty good plan. In fact, let's get all the U.S. forces out of Iraq by the end of 2010. It's just a coincidence, though, that we're saying the exact same thing Barack Obama is saying. Quite a little tizzy over at the White House. We have that. Radovan Karadzic, the butcher of Serbia, has been captured. I want to get into that in the second hour of our program. And, you know, the whole issue of war crimes and what should be done to war criminals. And in this case, what should be done to the war criminals in the Bush administration? We'll get into that in our second hour. Sutton Motley, in fact, the communications director for the Media Research Center, is going to drop by. The Republicans are quite concerned with all the coverage that Barack Obama is getting. And so we're going to ask him, you guys want to bring back the Fairness Doctrine? Is that the deal here? And in our third hour, the former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton, Michael Waldman, and executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University Law School, is going to drop by and talk about how to reboot democracy, how to restore democracy to America. And so we've got some interesting stuff around that as well. Our question, or our quote for the day, unless our conception of patriotism is progressive, it cannot hope to embody the real affection and the real interest of the nation. Jane Addams. And just a heads up, by the way, August 2nd and 3rd, weekend after next, if my calendar brain is correct, I'll be doing my show live from Madison, Wisconsin, from the Mike 92.1 WXXM. And on Saturday, we'll be speaking at the Nonstop Radio Symposium in the Exhibition Hall at Lion Energy Center. And you can get more information about that at nonstopradio.com. And August 16th, we'll be in Seattle, KPTK 1090. A whole big gig there at the Seattle Center Exhibition Hall. A bunch of different progressive talk show hosts will be there. Should be a lot of fun. Join us. How do we deal with our shampoo economy, as Jared Bernstein so accurately calls it, and yo-yo economics? You're on your own. Market fundamentalism. Here we've had a whole series of bubbles recently. Just in the last two decades, we've seen a housing bubble in the 90s. Then the IT bubble in the late 90s, early 2000, and now the housing and banking bubble again bursting. Should we just nationalize our money supply? Should we just say, hey, instead of the Fed and the private banks issuing currency, we're going to have the Treasury do it? You know, going back to some of the foundational notions that were debated at the founding of this country. Stephen Zarlenga is with us. He's the director of the American Monetary Institute, monetary.org. And, hey, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's so good to be on your show. I hear it here at WCPT in Chicago whenever I can.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Stephen. And you guys are doing just great work. You have produced the platform, one of the platform planks for the Green Party, suggesting essentially, I believe, what I just said. Let's have the Treasury issue our money and control our money supply, rather than essentially the Fed and the private banking system. Do I have that right?
That's basically right, and it was approved by their platform committee, and the next step in it is they're taking it up as a white paper, and we'll try to get a lot more interest built up in it. And it's exciting. The Green Party, what the platform committee approved, if it goes forward like that, it'd be historic, Tom. It's the first time anywhere, anyone any political party of that sort has put forward the whole monetary restructuring to put the nation on a really progressive road, away from warfare, away from this system of raping the middle class or the strong, simply taking financial advantage of the weak. And it's interesting that's the way Greider tried to redefine usury on the Moyers show last Friday, if you saw it.
I didn't see it, but yeah. William Greider, I'm a big fan of his work.
Yeah.
He's been on the show
yeah.
a number of times, a great guy. So let's talk about what this means in terms of the average person. What we are seeing, what working people have been seeing in the United States since 1913 when the Fed came into being, is, and we went to fractional reserve banking, which is where the size of our money supply is created by debt, 100% debt. Now, people think that our money is based on the net worth of the country, or that yeah. back before Nixon took us off the gold standard, our money supply was based on the amount of gold that we had in Fort Knox. Neither are true. Our money supply is a function of how much debt is out there, which is one of the reasons why the conservatives think it's such a great thing that the U.S. run up a huge debt, is because it increases the money supply. And the result of this is inflation. It decreases the, and with inflation, what happens is people are getting less and less real money for the work that they're doing. But the people who are inflation immunized, the very, very wealthy at the top, they make out just fine. Do I have that right?
Basically right. And it's not just the increase in the money supply, though, that causes inflation, because if money supply was increased and put into good things like production, and things like infrastructure, it would create real value. And that's
right. What I should say is increasing the money supply faster than the supply of goods and services is increasing.
Yeah,
because if they were parallel at all times, there would be no inflation.
Yeah, they are putting the money into particular areas that bankers are comfortable with and that they can make big profits on quickly. And they thought that real estate was the way, so they created a real estate bubble.
Right.
And now that's taking down a lot of people with it. This, we think, happens especially when you have private control of the money system. Our money system's been privatized. Our people think that the government's creating the money. As you mentioned, it's not. It's created when banks are lending credit, actually.
Right.
And
if I go to my bank and I say, I want to borrow $10,000 to buy a car, of that $10,000, about $9,000 of it is created out of thin air when the bank writes the check to me.
Yeah, that's assuming that there's a 10% reserve in the fractional reserve system. It's
right.
even more complicated than that. We're proposing, and what the Green Party is looking at, is basically doing what people think we have now. Let the government create the money.
Right.
That's what everyone thinks we have.
A government answerable to we the people.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
a novel idea. Rather
yeah.
than a
oh,
rather
yeah.
than a Federal Reserve System that's answerable to nobody.
Yeah, well, it's
answerable
a banking
to its
brotherhood or a
yeah.
kind of a group of banking people who have the same friends and they do what they think their friends are interested in. The argument that we make also, Tom, is that the money power, in fact, is always a fourth branch of government. Whether
right.
it's recognized as such or not, it'll function that way, and sometimes, quite often, it's more powerful than the other three branches combined.
And the reason why, and again, correct me if I have this wrong, but my understanding is that one of the reasons why, for example, Al Gore should be embracing this with his emphasis on sustainability is
yes.
that the way our current money supply is set up, it must infinitely grow
yes.
in order, and the economy must infinitely grow in order to avoid the problem of interest payments catching up with capital. In other words, basically
yeah.
a crash of the system. Whereas if we gave the supply of money, the control of the supply of money, took it out of the hands of private bankers and the Fed and put it into the hands of the Treasury Department, the U.S. Treasury Department, as,
yeah.
as you're suggesting, as the Green Party is suggesting, Stephen Zarlanga of the American Monetary Institute, monetary.org, then we could have a money supply that was absolutely sustainable. We could live within our means.
It would be rationally determined, and the important thing is we would base the running of it on the results. You see, the present system totally avoids looking at the effects that it creates, and what economists have allowed it to do, because of their training, or I should say mistraining, they've allowed the whole system to be based on theory. And you have economists who actually tell us that their theories cannot be disproven by the facts, believe it or not. They actually say that. So it's a question of methodology. We have to look at our experience. Now, we've learned this through our history, Tom, because we were a nation that did not have money at the beginning. Both the Dutch and the Brits refused to allow money over here into the colonies. So the colonists tried everything. We were a monetary laboratory. And we're a paper money nation from the beginning. It built our colonial infrastructure. There'd be no America without it. It gave us a country through the continental currency, which allowed us to beat Britain, the strongest power in the world at the time.
We're talking to Stephen Zarlenga, monetary.org. Stephen, I'd like to just very quickly get into the history of money in the United States and how, in some ways, sure, we fought the war against Great Britain because of their central bank's attempt to control, you know, our currency. If you can stick around after the break. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. Three theories of money. One, money is merely a medium of exchange. In that case, it doesn't matter who controls the money supply as long as they keep it stable. And that's kind of the way that the road we've been going down in 1913, giving our money supply over to the Federal Reserve Bank, privately, a government-created corporation, but privately owned. Number two, money is in and of itself a commodity with value. This is the Ron Paul worldview of money, that money should be backed up by gold or silver because in and of itself it must have value. Problem with that is if you don't have enough gold or silver in Fort Knox, your money supply can't accommodate changes in your economy, and you have a lot of, it can be very problematic, which is why most of the world has moved away from that. Or number three, money is part of the social contract that we have with each other and with our government. And therefore, we and our government should control our money supply, not the banks. Stephen Zarlenga of the American Monetary Institute, monetary.org. Do I have that right, these three models of money that are the three historic ways of looking at money?
Those are the three basic ways, Tom. Now, the first one about gold is falling apart because historically it's untenable. So the people who have been pushing that have switched to something called competitive currencies. We can talk about that. But, yeah, that's the general picture still today. And it comes back to what is the nature of money? What's the concept of money?
Right.
And we take our cue on that from Aristotle. He created the science of money in the 4th century BC, and it's summarized in one sentence. Money exists not by nature, but by law. So he's placing money into the category of a societal legal power, an abstract power. It's not wealth in itself in that terminology. It's a power to obtain wealth. And with that definition, it's very easy to see why government has to be involved, since it's a legal power.
Right. And you're also, by the way, the author of a book. Is it the Law? I'm sorry, I don't have the title in front of me.
The Lost Science of Money.
The Lost Science of Money. Thank you very much, Stephen Zarlenga.
Yeah, Aristotle gave us the science, and what happens is society discovers it, grows on that science, it gets corrupted and lost.
So I know that the Canadians, for a while, didn't get rid of their central bank, but they nationalized it. They said, we're going to buy it back from the bankers, and for a while, Canada's treasury ran things, but then the bankers got in there snuck up on it. England did this for a while, the United Kingdom. Is there a movement worldwide for countries to say enough with the central banks already
There is. We represent it here in America. We don't get the kind of publicity that we should be getting because you know who owns the media for the most part. It's financial institutions.
Companies associated with the banks, right?
Yeah, and they all owe money to the banks, and, you know, they're limited by what they can do. But that's essentially accurate. Canada did, for a while, under one leader, McGeer, they developed an independence, creating money by their own central bank. They still have that power, and there's movement by some people, and they're linked at our website to move in that direction.
Now, this could be very progressive, because you're suggesting that the way that the government should increase the money supply as the economy grows is by spending money into the economy with public works projects. This is,
yep,
rather than regulating interest rates and debt as the Fed does, you're
doesn't
saying
work.
That the Treasury, right, it doesn't work. It creates these bubbles. You're saying that the Treasury, if they want to increase the money supply by $1 billion, they should buy $1 billion worth of roads or bridges.
Exactly. And the American Society of Civil Engineers does a study every 2 years. Every congressman and senator gets it. They tell us now we're $1.6 trillion behind to make our infrastructure safe, just to make it safe, not perfect. So everyone would agree we need the infrastructure. What they would say is, well, where are we going to get the money? This is where you get the money. And
see,
this applies to all other areas as well, where there's actual stuff being created. And, Tom, very importantly, in infrastructure, we include health care and we include education, human infrastructure, because you cannot build hardware unless you have healthy, intelligent people.
Right. This is absolutely brilliant. Stephen Zerlinga, the American Monetary Institute, monetary.org. We just have a minute left. You're not suggesting doing away with the Fed. You're suggesting buying it back from the bankers.
Yes.
And you know, having it, you know, work
right.
as a regulatory agency and work with the banks.
The Fed has good reasons to exist, but it belongs. It should be nationalized, paid for, whatever, put into the United States Treasury Department in a particular department. A monetary control board gets formed. We're working out some of the details on this, and that continues. It's a continuing process.
The platform, and this is now part of the platform for the Green Party. In just a few seconds left, Stephen Zerlinga, any chance that this is going to go mainstream soon?
It depends on some of the political people. We know that a number of them understand this, Tom. But
right.
they don't think that they've got an audience out there.
Right. No more bubbles, no more inflation, no more rich bankers, just a banking system that works of, by, and for the people.
Yeah.
What a radical idea.
Oh, my God. Can't have that, huh?
No, we can't have that.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah,
Thank you so much.
Stephen Zerlinga, thanks so much for being with us. Check out his website, monetary.org. Should we nationalize our money supply?
We have a free CD for anybody that goes to the website. We put it on there just for your show. We'll mail them a free CD for 1 hour on monetary reform.
Oh, that's great. That's great. For people who really want to become money wonks, it's a fine thing. Stephen Zerlinga, monetary.org. 27 minutes past the hour. How do you think we should change our money system?
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Well, our Name the Kitten contest update. So far, Louise's favorite names that have been suggested are Magnum P.I., Chewbacca, and Fang. The funniest name, Asina, from the Disney movies. So Louise says, sorry, ain't happening. And definitely not going to happen. Names that have been suggested, Rumsfeld, Rush, or Hannity. Who would do that to a kitten? Even if he does attack everything in sight. I mean, you just don't want to do that. It's too much. So, anyhow, George W. Bush, he's the gift that keeps on giving. Yeah, what a friend we have in W. Oh, yeah.
Upright, strong, and brave.
Well, actually, what a friend the GOP has in W.
God wished him to be our leader. The courts
just had to go along. So anyhow, here's what's the result of all this. The Nevada Republican Party, citing a lack of interest, has called off its state convention and instead will pick its delegates to the national convention by private conference call. Yep, they've canceled their convention, the Republicans in Nevada. Thanks so much, George. We so appreciate you.
When the day of choice arrives.
By the way, speaking of the day of choice, in Canada, this an interesting story. This is from globalresearch.ca. The New Democratic Party, this is one of the multiple parties that Canada has. What a novel idea. The New Democratic Party House Leader, Libby Davies, delivered a parliamentary petition in Canada's House of Commons during routine proceedings at 1:10 p.m. This was actually back in June. I just now learned about it. This petition of the House of Commons in Parliament assembled, we the undersigned citizens of Canada draw the attention of the House to the following. And then they go through a list of concerns that they have that the 9/11 Commission report, well, specifically, scientific and eyewitness evidence shows that the 9/11 Commission report is a fraudulent document. And they go on to say, therefore, your petitioners call upon a parliament to immediately launch its own investigation into the events of 9/11/2001 on behalf of the 24 Canadian citizens murdered in New York City. And two, to act lawfully on the findings of its own investigation by helping to pursue the guilty parties in international court. Fascinating. So anyway, how do we reform our money system? How can we make it? This is totally out of control. We have an economy that is dependent upon bubbles to work. Most people don't have any clue how this works. Even I didn't for a long, long time. I always thought the money supply of the United States was a reflection of the net worth of the United States. It's not. It's a reflection of the debt out there. Actually, the money supply should be a reflection of the net worth. But the money supply is increased or decreased by the creation or repayment of debt, which means that if you want to grow the economy, you have to grow the debt, which makes absolutely no sense. And the money supply also isn't set up in a way that accommodates the payment of interest. So you always will have losers in this kind of economy because the money supply isn't creating the money to pay back the interest. It's like musical chairs. When the music stops, somebody's left out. And that somebody is the middle class now. Lauren in Alaska. Hey, Lauren, what's up?
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call. I find it very difficult to see these Republicans, conservative Christians, fight for a fetus's life in the womb and then abandon them for the rest of their lives based on the religious, precept that they have. But I would like to basically remind them of the precept to not cause people to suffer under the burden of usury.
Usury is the payment of interest.
And
in Judaism, in Christianity, in Islam, and in Hinduism, the four of the world's major religions, usury, charging any interest whatsoever, is absolutely verboten. In fact, there are banks in the Middle East, a number of them, where they just charge fees to lend money. They never charge interest because it's against Islamic law.
As I understand it, too, if you do loan someone money, that after 7 years, if they don't pay it back, you have to forgive that loan.
Yeah, and, the idea of the Jubilee, yeah.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, there would be no subprime anything if these conditions were, nobody slipping under a radar.
Yep, excellent point, Lauren. Thank you very much for calling and making it. And should we outlaw the charging of interest? Here, if you go back to the founding of this country, there was a lot of discussion about whether people who made money off money were criminals and were leeches. And now what you have are seminars on how to make money with money. And George Bush has said it's such a superior way to earn an income that your maximum income tax rate, if you earn money with money, that is, if you make your living off dividends or interest, dividends or capital gains, your maximum income tax rate, even if you're making millions or billions of dollars, is 15%. Whereas if you earn your income through the sweat of your brow, your maximum income rate is in the 30s. Jess, Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Yeah, I was listening to your conversation there. Can I cover two topics?
Sure, if it's quick. I mean, we got a bunch of people who want to get in here.
I gave a lot of thought to the wealth of a nation, and mm-hmm. Gave a lot of thought to this, and to me, it's the amount of gold that you have stored away in a vault,
Well, see, that's the Ron Paul theory. The problem is
that's only one of them. There's three in all.
Well,
there's gold, the amount of gold you have in your vault, or the amount of natural resources your nation has, as an example, Russia, or your ability to manufacture goods to be sold on the world market, as an
or
example.
Provide services. I mean, look at India, right?
China and India, and we come up lacking terribly.
Yeah. Well, our gold, you know, good point. Our gold reserves are gone, you know, we're no longer, but see, we're not on the gold standard. So I don't think that matters. The trust and faith of the government. I mean, that's the thing, you know, is our economy solid? Is our government standing behind the money? And increasingly the world is saying, no, don't think so. So let's privatize the let's nationalize the Federal Reserve. Let's say we now own it. Jess in Los Angeles. Hey, Jess.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I had been told that Abraham Lincoln, when he was president, issued $500 million worth of interest-free notes, also known as greenbacks.
Yes.
And that actually Mr. President Kennedy had issued the same notes. Why can't we use interest-free notes to pay for things so that we wouldn't have to sit there and be obligated for 30, 40 years to pay for a debt? Also, can we trade these interest-free notes dollar for dollar with the existing United States Treasury bills?
I don't think so. And I didn't know that Kennedy had anything to do with that, so I can't speak to that. But Lincoln was an outspoken opponent of fractional reserve banking, mm-hmm. and wanted there to be a national currency regulated, controlled by and regulated by the Treasury rather than by bankers. And he spoke out against bankers, and it's fueled a virtual industry of conspiracy theories suggesting that bankers assassinated Lincoln, which I personally don't subscribe to. But, you know, nonetheless, there it is. The argument against this is one I think Barrett is going to share with us from Binghamton, New York on WNYY. Hey, Barrett.
Hi. Just a couple of quick questions. If the government controls the printing of the currency, and with the debt that we have, what keeps them from just printing more money to pay off the national debt? And number two, who sets the value of any given currency? I mean, we pay a dollar for an item because that item costs X number of cents to produce, but who says it costs that? What if it costs half that and their suppliers have?
The value of a currency is largely set by the number of units of that currency, in our case dollars, the number of dollars in circulation divided by the total volume of goods and services in the economy that are being traded in dollars. So mm-hmm. as the economy grows, if the number of dollars doesn't grow, then you'll have deflation, which is what happened in the 30s with the Republican Great Depression, and although the economy stopped growing also, but you'll have the cost of everything dropping, but the value of the dollar increasing. On the other hand, if the number of dollars in circulation grows faster than the number of goods and services in circulation, then you have inflation. But your first point is, if the government has the ability to control the money supply, if we did what the Green Party is suggesting and the American Monetary Institute is suggesting and said, okay, the Treasury Department is going to control the money supply, yes, in fact, it would be possible for the Treasury Department to say, we're going to inflate the money supply and, for our own nefarious purposes. The point, though, is right now that's what the Fed is doing. It's what the Fed has been doing since 1913, and there's no way to hold them to account for it. They're not accountable to us. The Treasury Department is. The Treasury Department has to answer to Congress, the Treasury, who has to answer to us every 2 years. I frankly would prefer to have the Treasury Department have this under the control of the Treasury Department, and like that. I think that that's a better way to do it. Tony in Bellevue, Washington. We got a minute before the break. Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, how you doing, man? You know what? This is the best topic I've heard you discuss in a long time, man. Even though they're all good. This subject goes all the way back. There are three very distinct periods in United States monetary history, according to me, of course. The last one, we're in the last one right now, and that's after the divorcing of us from monetary policy.
Right. Tony, hang on for just a second. Let me put you on hold. We'll pick this up on the other side. It's 45 minutes past the hour right here on the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. Our number 866-303-2270, our website TomHartmann.com and AirAmerica.com. And you can click over to the Tom Hartmann page there. We also have Tom Vision. You can see there's a link to that right off our homepage. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Well, little George might strike you as a rube, ah, but he's the one that's grinning on the tube. He knows he owes it all to Dad, that and several hanging chads. Yeah, little George, he's smirking right at you. Na 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 na.
9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartmann here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and let's see. We were talking to Tony in Bellevue. Tony, I'm sorry. I need to turn up the volume in my earpiece here. I missed my time cue. Thought I had a minute. I had 30 seconds, and I had to cut you off. So go ahead.
Not a problem, Tom. Thank you. I appreciate you, man. Hey, okay, like I was saying, three distinct periods in American monetary history. One, the one we're in right now, is the post-gold standard. Then you have the gold standard with the paper currency. And then you go back to the original standard, which is that Congress shall be, authorized to coin money. Now, George Bancroft, in his book, A Plea for the Constitution, which was written in the 1870s, immediately following the Supreme Court case that brought paper money into legal tender, made paper money legal tender, explained through his intimate knowledge. George Bancroft, by the way, was not only intimately aware with or intimately familiar with the founding fathers. He talked with them all the time about various policies. He served as Secretary of Navy. He also was the founder of the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, and he laid out very clearly in his book, A Plea for the Constitution, the reasons why the founding fathers did not want paper currency in the United States of America.
Right. No, I get that, and I'm familiar with the argument. And as I said, it's the argument that Ron Paul, the libertarians, the gold bugs make, and I think you could have made that argument in 1776.
No, this supersedes Ron Paul, and paper money being made legal tender, except for certain circumstances like during times of war, during times of great need, was not the case. The people were more enlightened than they are today, and they understood the nature of money and the nature of the people who would have an instrument like paper money become legal tender. They knew what the.
I really, respectfully, Tony, and thank you for the call and raising the issue. I don't believe that that's what the founders had in mind. If you read the Constitution, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the national defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States, number one. Number two, this is Section 8 of Article 1 of the Constitution. Number two, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Number three, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and the Indian tribes. Number four, to establish uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. Number five, to coin money. Now, they capitalized the word money. They didn't capitalize the word coin. And in the late 1700s, when the Constitution was written, typically capitalization was a form of emphasis. To coin capital money, regulate the capital V value thereof, and of further capital C coin, and fix the, quote, standard of capital S standard of weights, capital W weights, and measures, capital M measures. In other words, say we're going to use pounds and feet and inches and ounces and, you know, whatever. And to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. And so securities, which is capitalized, by the way, as is coin, again, I think refers to paper. I don't think that the founders were opposed to paper. I think that they were opposed to a fractional banking system, basically. Clark in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Clark. Clark, you're on the air. Okay, well, Clark, you got to turn off your radio. And Dave, I don't have – Dave, are you in Washington, D.C.?
No, I'm not. I'm in Los Angeles, Tom, and thanks for this topic.
Okay.
one of the things that we need to do, in my opinion, is, of course, get rid of the central bank, the Fed, as we've done three times before in American history. But we need to revisit the Silverites of the early 1900s. And what they said is you don't want to back the money with gold. There's too little of it, and it's controlled by too few people. But silver, it's
a remember the Hunt brothers?
Yeah, well, yeah, but that, and
I mean, in the 1970s, they successfully cornered the market on silver. They drove silver from four or five bucks like an ounce up to 20 or something, as I recall.
Just like, yeah, but what they did is exactly, that's why the regulations for crude oil, that's what's going on today with the Enron loophole. That's sure. What caused those regulations. But silver is a natural resource that can be mined. You can expand it to account for growth and population growth. And the European central bankers were so afraid of this in the early 1900s, they sent a lobbyist over with, I think, $250,000 and the promise of a limited budget to lobby against any kind of silver backing of the money, which was ongoing at the time. There was a bill.
Well, and they would be equally opposed, I think, to the Green Party's position and the American Monetary Institute's position that the government should simply, that the Treasury should be coining and determining the value of our currency as opposed to the Fed. Right now, the way the value of our currency is determined is by the amount of it in circulation, and the amount of it in circulation is determined by the creation of debt. We have money. Our money supply is created by debt, period.
Every dollar printed comes with an inherent debt.
Well, it has to, because that's the point. The way that with a fractional banking system like we have, a fractional reserve system, the only way you can increase the money supply is by creating debt, is by authorizing banks to write loans. And when they write that loan, that money is created out of thin air. Every bank in America is the printing press. The federal government can't run the printing presses, as you say, or as people say, to create more money. I mean, they can create more currency, more physical paper, but that just means that there'll be, fewer electronic dollars floating around. It's all going to balance out. The actual creation of currency is in the banking system. And the banking
at the
system,
local banks, you're correct.
That's right. And the banking system is entirely private. It is not owned by the government. The head of the Fed is appointed by the president, and so it's kind of a patina, a little bit of a lipstick on the pig, to make us think that we somehow own it or control it. But the fact of the matter is, we don't.
To find out who owns the Fed.
Well, the Fed is owned by its 12 member banks in the United States, and the stock in those 12 member banks is owned by people all over the world. And a good chunk of it is owned by people outside the United States. Another good chunk
Correct.
Of it is owned by some very, very wealthy individuals inside the United States. And a relatively small chunk of it is owned by people like you and me, who may have a little bit of money in a 401k or whatever, and invest in their local bank. But nonetheless, it's all privately held. And that's where I think it's time for us to consider doing what Canada did and what England did briefly. And they should have stuck with it, but they just they couldn't withstand the political pressure of all that money from the bankers. And that is nationalize the Fed. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. Seton Motley is with us. He is the communications director for the Media Research Center, mediaresearch.org, the conservative media watchdog group. Seton, welcome to the program.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You folks are quite concerned, I guess, that Brian Williams, Charlie Gibson, Katie Couric, that they're all going with Barack Obama to Europe and the Middle East.
Never happened before for a presidential candidate ever.
Yeah, so isn't this great news that America is paying attention to and the American networks are paying attention to the candidates?
They're not paying attention to the candidates, they're propping up the candidate.
Ah, I
this
see.
This is a ongoing traveling PR roadshow.
So you think that there's a disproportionate amount of coverage being given to Barack Obama versus John McCain?
The numbers back it up.
Right.
It's almost 2-1 in minutes dedicated to the two candidates.
So is the Media Research Center officially going to join the many folks out there who are calling for a return of the Fairness Doctrine?
How does that work? Well, does Brian Williams preface his show by saying, "I'm a liberal, here we go"? Rush Limbaugh does.
Well, Brian Williams is doing news. Rush Limbaugh is doing commentary, as am I.
Then why do you need the fairness? Why not have the fairness doctrine apply to Brian Williams? He's not doing news. He's doing commentary.
Right. So it sounds to me like you're suggesting that the fairness doctrine there should be some federal law that forces the media to disclose their bias.
No, it's unconstitutional.
Okay. Then what are you complaining about?
Because these guys are pretending to be objective news analysts.
No, they're not. These guys are making money. NBC is a giant corporation.
They're losing money hand over fist. They're losing viewers hand over fist. They are sacrificing the bottom line on the altar of ideology.
What they are doing, we're talking with Seton Motley, the communications director of the Media Research Center. What they're doing is providing the same thing that I think both of us decry when they do coverage of Britney Spears' underwear, is they're doing what will draw eyeballs to TV sets to watch their newscasts so they can sell advertising.
The facts don't back up what you're saying, Tom. The facts are they're losing viewers. They have been losing viewers.
Broadly speaking, they're trying to bring them back by covering Barack Obama. The guy's a rock star.
The guy's a rock star according to the media.
The guy's a rock star when he can draw 70,000 people here in Portland, Oregon just by showing up.
Yeah, the big band didn't hurt any. The Decemberists.
I don't think that it had any. You know, I live in Portland, Oregon. I can tell you, I didn't even know there was a band plan. The band had nothing to do with it.
The media didn't tell you that because it inflated the numbers, and the media didn't want to tell you that because it would have diminished the story of Barack Obama.
I see. So I guess we're back to let's bring back the fairness.
No, I don't want to limit free speech.
I want
Rush Limbaugh on the air. I want Laura Ingraham on the air. I want Mark Levin on the air to help counteract what Brian Williams, Katie Couric, and Charlie Gibson are currently doing.
I'm all in favor of all of them being on the air, just as I rather like my being on the air, and particularly the fact that I've beat Rush Limbaugh in a couple of different markets now in the ratings. But the point is that people are voting with, and I hate this phraseology because, you know, we live in a democracy, not a marketplace. Actually, we live in both, but our governance is democracy, or a republic, a constitutionally limited republic. But the fact of the matter is that NBC, ABC, CBS, these are all for-profit enterprises.
But they're losing money, Tom, you keep going back to that, and they're losing money. Covering Barack Obama and being liberal has been losing the money for years. How are they attending to the bottom line by being more liberal?
Well, being liberal let me finish my sentence, Seton, and maybe you'll get it, okay? These three and then you could respond. These three companies are for-profit enterprises. They're profit-making enterprises. They may be losing money, but they're supposed to be profit-making enterprises. And when Clinton assigned the Telecommunications Act in 96, and when Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine in 87, the combined effect of those two things was that the news departments, which always had lost money, because they were required to be there in order to fulfill the public service requirements of radio stations and television stations to get their licenses renewed, those news departments ceased to be standalone news departments and came under the umbrella in all three networks of the entertainment divisions and started answering to profit. I mean, we even have a couple of Fox TV stations now where they're doing product placements, where they're putting Starbucks cups out or whatever the brand is of coffee in front of it. You know, well...
I have no problem with that. My
point is that if you've got a for-profit corporation providing infotainment to us and they're doing it in a way that's most profitable to them, they're going to go follow the rock star, not the boring old guy who has been in our face for 25 years.
They're doing it, Tom. You keep saying that, and it hasn't changed. You're still wrong. They haven't been gaining ratings by being liberal. They've been losing ratings by being liberal. So how is being more liberal and following this guy around for daily on-the-air massages from Europe and the Middle East going to help them when they've been losing money being liberal all this time?
Are you suggesting, Seton Motley, that the ratings for the big three networks in their coverage of Obama in the Middle East and Europe are going to be down from the previous week?
Yes. I'm not precipitously, but it's all a part of the continuing decline of their ratings. Yes.
So the
Rasmussen poll yesterday, half of Americans think that the media is going to go out of their way to help Barack Obama get elected. It certainly stands to reason when the three of them travel on the road. By the way, 2 weeks after ABC chastised McCain five times in two segments on July 2nd for being in Colombia when America's economy is in peril.
So there's two remedies to this, it seems. Tell me if there are others that I'm missing. One remedy, which I think both you and I agree is not the remedy that we would like, is to bring back, or not even to bring back. I mean, the Fairness Doctrine was never even this draconian.
How is silencing Rush Limbaugh help Brian Williams?
I'm not suggesting Limbaugh should be silenced.
Well, that's what the Fairness Doctrine does. You don't understand.
Please, no. See, I agree with you. Stop. Just a second. The two remedies that I can see for this are number one, some sort of governmental action that requires Brian Williams to tell the world that he's a liberal.
I don't want the government involved.
Or number two, the stockholders of these corporations have to take them to account. Are you doing something about that?
Yes, we are. We were contacting the board of directors because the board of directors don't know. The NBC is GE, one of many in the GE portfolio. And once they finally start paying attention to them and realizing that the liberal hacks running the news divisions of the NBC and the other divisions, the other broadcast networks, are going to look at them and say, why are we continuing to allow you to run the show the way you're running the show?
Yeah, I get it. Do you think it's possible that the reason why the big three networks have been losing market share over the last 5, 6, 7 years is because they have been buying the Bush line, they were cheerleaders for the war, and Fox News does that more effectively?
Well, wait a minute. How could you just contradicted yourself? If cheerleading for the war costs them ratings, how is Fox News' ratings through the roof if they're the best at it?
Well,
you just contradicted yourself, Tom.
Tom, you want to work this out with yourself
before you have me on?
No, I'm serious. I mean, you think about this for a minute.
You're contradicting yourself in one sentence.
How so?
Staggering.
How so?
You just said the networks are losing ratings for being cheerleaders for the war.
Right, because people are going to Fox.
That makes no sense, Tom.
Isn't that what Fox is saying is going on?
Excuse me. We just issued a report yesterday. Through January 1 through July 15th of the last 2 years, the number of deaths in Iraq have fallen by 64%. The number of stories about the war have fallen by 65%.
That's because all three networks have shut down their Iraq bureaus. They don't want the expense. They don't want the risk.
Yes,
None of them have a full-time Iraq bureau.
There's no bad news to report. So they don't want to report it. So they shut down the bureaus.
No.
How is America going to know that we've, for all intents and purposes,
no, they shut down the bureaus because they want to make more money.
How are the American people going to know that we, for all intents and purposes, won the Iraq war if the networks are shut down their bureaus and are no longer reporting it?
Oh, I think the American people know that we won the Iraq war. I mean, you know, George Bush announced it, and we all heard it. You know, it's
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And he was right. On May 1st, 2003, he was right. And that, the war was over, and then began the occupation. Now, we're screwing up the occupation
pretty
badly. No,
the occupation is, for all intents and purposes, a success.
Well, it seems to be getting a little better, but if you like ethnic cleansing, if you're in the Radovan Karadzic school,
you've got
2.5 million external refugees, you've got 2 million internal refugees, you've got entire parts of Baghdad that are ethnic cleansing.
Talking and open your mind and your ears. Where in Iraq is ethnic cleansing occurring?
All across the nation.
Give me a specific town or city or province.
In large parts of Baghdad, for example, you've got entire neighborhoods that are now walled off with blast fences and razor wire.
That was true a year ago. Apparently, the media.
You don't acknowledge that there's 2.5 million Iraqi refugees outside the country,
and they're returning.
Okay, so everything is wonderful. Seton Motley, the communications director for the Media Research Center. You can read all about it at mediaresearch.org. Seton, good talking with you. Thanks for dropping by. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
We're fighting for. Is it still our creed from shore to shore? After a soldier fights, should we read him his new rights? There's not that many to read anymore. Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for?
Well, Barack Obama is a rock star. The headline, Obama's Magical Media Tour, Day 2, Media Orgy. Is Obama getting too much coverage? Most believe reporters trying to help Obama. See, I'm telling you, the Media Research Group's message is starting to get out there. They are playing the refs. And I think they're is Obama playing media favorites? Obama's revenge, New Yorker reporter banned from press plane for overseas trip. Is media playing fair in campaign coverage? Half of U.S. has press pro-Obama. I think they're getting their message out, and apparently Obama is too. And now John McCain, he submitted a piece to the New York Times in rebuttal to Barack Obama's op-ed. And as they did multiple times when Bill Clinton was president, yes, they did multiple times. When Bill Clinton was president, the New York Times said, "Nah, don't think we want to run that. We're not gonna run that article that you've written." Although Dick Morris, in a conversation with Alan Colmes, was a little off the wall.
On tell a president of the United States candidate what to write.
Do.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
When a president writes, I doubt they changed a comma in Obama's piece.
Yeah, right. Well, they accepted Obama's piece. But the fact of the matter is that numerous times Bill Clinton submitted pieces to the New York Times. The New York Times sent him back saying, nope, not going to run it, or please change it. So who publishes it? Well, of course, Rupert Murdoch. Surprise, surprise. It's published over in the New York Post. But there are issues. Actually, I think that there is a larger issue here, and it's an important issue, and that is that the news media is not covering stuff that's really going on in the world. For example, they're not covering Radovan Karadžić's arrest. They're not covering the rape camps, for example. It's almost never discussed. Rape is an instrument of war. Radovan Karadžić was a psychiatrist, and he organized this program where women were systematically raped. This is from a news story in The Guardian. Videos show Foča. This is the town of Foča, a sleepy town of red-roofed buildings, including the partisan sports hall, the high school, and the Hotel Zelaringa, all later used as rape camps. What happened to the Muslim women of Foča occurred purely because of their ethnicity or religion and because they were women. And they, women held in the partisan sports hall were raped almost nightly for a month. And large percentages of them became pregnant as a result of this, which was Radovan Karadžić's goal. Some estimates run as high as 200,000 women, ages as low as 12, who were subject to this repeatedly. Not to mention the 8,000 people that he murdered, men and boys that he murdered in Srebrenica and other places. So Radovan Karadžić was arrested overnight. And we're not talking about that, number one, much in the news media. They're not talking about that, frankly, at all. Rape is a weapon of war. All the various countries where rape has been used as a weapon of war. I saw it when we were with Ellen Ratner and Rusty Humphreys and Jack Rice and my son Justin and Dan Patterson in southern Sudan, right on the border with Darfur. We in several camps, we would ask, you know, what happened to you? Did you have family members who died? Everybody raised their hand. Were you raped? Every woman raises her hand. I mean, these are weapons of war. This is not a major subject in the media. It should be. And as a piece of this, the war crimes of George W. Bush should be being covered. Now, Bush, you know, I suppose to his credit, didn't organize rape camps in Iraq or Afghanistan. But the fact of the matter is that that ethnic cleansing has occurred in Iraq. There are 4.5 million refugees in that country, 2 million of them inside the country, 2.5 million outside the country. The New York Times and other media have done a marvelous job of documenting how the new center for sex tourism in the world, for illegal sex tourism, for sex with children, for the new center for illegal sex tourism in the world is now Syria. And it's Iraqi refugees who are so desperate for money that 8, 10, 12, 14-year-old girls are prostituting themselves in Syria. And as they showed, I think it was 60 Minutes we saw this, or maybe it was MSNBC, I don't remember which network did a really good documentary on it. They went in and they looked at the parking lots of these places, and most of the cars had Saudi license plates. Yeah, you can drive from Saudi Arabia to Syria. It's the new sex center of the world. Why? Because of the refugees, this huge refugee crisis. These are the war crimes of George W. Bush. 4.5 million refugees, as many as a million dead, the newest report out of the UK, certainly a minimum of 100,000 absolutely innocent civilians dead, not to mention over 4,000 U.S. soldiers and we don't know exactly how many people who are just employees of companies who went over just trying to earn a living for their families dead as a consequence of George W. Bush. So the question I ask you, one that Carl Wilson asked on our morning show here on KPOJ, I think it's a really important one. When George W. Bush finds himself standing next to Radovan Karadžić in the dock in The Hague for war crimes, Karadžić for his rape camps and his murder of 8,000 people in Srebrenica, Bush for his creating the world's largest humanitarian crisis, the largest refugee crisis in the world, 4.5 million displaced persons in Iraq, and the murder of over 100,000 people for no reason other than political gain for the Republican Party. When Bush finds himself standing next to Karadžić, what should be his punishment if he is convicted of war crimes? 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You have your $217.39 ready. That's your share of the $25 billion bailout of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. $217 a family for the 115 million working families in America. Strange stuff going on all over the world, it seems. This Batman star, Christian Bale, busted for assault. Apparently against his mother and sister. Very strange. We'll see how this story develops, but here you go. Batman is the bad guy? I don't think it's supposed to work that way. But apparently it does. Okay, and we've got this male silver tiger kitty who is a Higgins wannabe. All he does is attack. Constantly attacks. Last night it was like he was following me around biting my feet. And we've got to come up with a name for this cat. So we're taking your suggestions over on our homepage at TomHartman.com. And thank you very much for that. What, it's a marvel, it's a wonderful thing. Radovan Karadžić, the butcher of Serbia, has been arrested and will be transported to The Hague. He has 3 days to appeal it, but in all probability will be transported to The Hague to stand court in the International Criminal Court. The man has done horrific things. Crimes of war. And to what extent, and what, you know, the maximum punishment he faces is life in prison. What should we do about George W. Bush? In your opinion. 866-303-2270, our number, Dan in Miami. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to tell you that I'm cracking open the champagne. I'm happier than I've ever been because last night I turned on Hannity and Combs and heard Sean Hannity crying because Barack Obama is getting all this attention. Then I switched the channel to CNN. Glenn Beck was standing in, and he was crying about how Barack Obama is getting all this attention. And then I just heard this guy on your show. I think it's absolutely hysterical.
Yeah. And then you say to them, okay, great, let's bring back the fairness doctrine. They're like, oh, no, wait a minute, I don't want to do away with Rush Limbaugh, you know.
Nothing makes me happier than hearing these guys cry.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Here's the question that I have. 7.5 years of Republican rule. We've got a failing economy, 1 million homes in foreclosure. We've got Fannie Mae corporate welfare bailouts. We got $500 billion on a war that's resulted in a propped up Iran friendly government that wants us out. and 4,000 lives gone. The question that I have for you is, and this is, you're the only person I think that might be able to answer this question. I cannot figure this out for the life of me. I've always thought that Republicans were all about money, and it was all about the money. Well, in the past 7.5 years, with this economy and what's going on, these guys have got to be losing their shorts.
No, they're making a fortune. They're on the war. They're making an absolute friggin' fortune. This is a trillion-dollar war, and that money is going to the cronies and buddies, the big Republican donors. It's going to the oil companies. I mean, when Bush came into office, oil was 20-something a barrel. Now it's 120-something a barrel. I mean, gasoline is gone. Everything. The people getting screwed are the middle class, and the Republican Party has never given a damn about the middle class. The people who are making out really well are the very, very wealthy, and they're making out better than they ever have before. Bush has dropped their maximum income tax rate down to 15%. I mean, they're making out like bandits, Dan. Real quick question. I want to ask this question of all our callers, and I've got to move along. If George W. Bush is convicted of war crimes in The Hague, what should be his punishment?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah.
I think you should go to jail.
Okay. You life in prison or going to jail. Bob in San Jose, California. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. I'm calling you basically kind of in a reply to that fellow you had on earlier.
To Mr. Motley?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 80% of the TV audience now watches through either satellite or cable. They don't watch over-the-air TV. And what's gone on is satellite and cable both offer many more choices of channels.
Right.
So people, if you think of it in another way, years ago there were like three big networks, and if you were lucky, you had maybe 10 or 12 stations to choose from in total.
Right.
But that was only in major metropolitan areas. Now with cable, you're looking at 90, 100 channels, and with satellite, even more.
Right. Everybody understands that. That's the main reason why the big three networks are losing money.
That's one reason. Yeah. The next one is people are working more hours than they used to. I mean, now people are working two or three jobs. I mean, I remember George Bush commenting on that, in fact.
Yes, isn't that an all-American thing? Yes.
So that means less time left for watching television.
Yeah.
Three, news, because it's now had to become a profit center, what would you do? Field a reporter and send that team somewhere to get real facts, or get a quote-unquote expert to sit behind a desk and talk?
Right. Or
that's what Fox is all about.
Right.
Very rarely do they send real reporters anywhere.
Right.
And then
it's a stalker for O'Reilly.
Yeah. And then the last one is we've got many more alternative distribution things going on now. People can choose to play video discs, like DVDs. They can download stuff through the internet.
Yeah.
And so there's even more choice. So we're looking at that even more diluting of the audience. So when they cry about how TV audiences are going down, well, maybe TV's not the only choice anymore.
Yeah. Amen, Bob. Thank you very much. And it's got nothing, and in my opinion, it's got nothing to do with liberal bias or, frankly, even conservative bias. I think what we have is a much larger marketplace. Victor in Santa Fe, listening on KTRC. Hey, Victor.
Yeah, just real quick to your question. I, of course, don't believe in the death penalty, and he wouldn't get it anyway. But I do believe that, personally, George Bush should be put in prison and personally impoverished for the rest of his life. More importantly, though, and this would be very difficult to do ethically and, practically, perhaps, but I would like to see some framework put in place whereby the Bush family political dynasty, such as it is, and especially the crony network that created them, would have no access to the means of political power anywhere in the world.
Right. Yeah, that what you're talking about, and thank you very much, Victor, you're talking about major electoral reform in the United States. The two things we need, the two really structural things we need are electoral reform. We need to have publicly owned elections that have no corporations owning voting machines and don't have big money interests in them. We own the elections. Number one, we need to have complete electoral reform. And number two, monetary reform, which is the first hour of this program. We need to nationalize the Fed. Harold in Lakewood, Florida, listening to Wins. Hey, Harold. Harold, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Tom, I got a very simple point. NBC, ABC, and CBS are brand names. We don't talk about Chevrolet. GE owns NBC. It's GE News. Anybody who thinks GE is a liberal corporation is out of his mind. I mean, they're not liberal corporations. you know, you're talking about a company that sells nuclear bombs and jet engines to the military, and they're interested in profits, and they don't care if it's liberal or conservative.
Yeah, I agree with you, Harold. I would argue that if there is a political bias to these big corporations, it is a Republican bias, but that by and large, they're making just business decisions. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Bonnie.
Oh, hi. Well, people have already covered what I was going to say about why media are losing their market share, the broadcast media anyway. So I just don't add to that that only older people watch that kind of news. And you know what happens when we get older? We die. But I'd also like to add that MSNBC's ratings are growing because of personalities like Keith Olbermann.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Rachel Maddow.
Yep.
And what to do with George Bush, that's a great question. And I was listening to your program this morning, and I thought, I would like to see him go to jail for life and then become an advocate to change what's happening in our jails. And I thought he would never be an advocate for anything good. He only knows things about destroying.
Yeah, I agree, Bonnie. I don't think he's constitutionally capable of it. Well said. Thank you. Weldon in Minnesota. Hey, Weldon.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for everything you do. I have three things. First of all, I'm glad to see that you're reading stuff off globalresearch.ca. And second, I don't think you want to name the cat Magnum PI simply because Tom Selleck is a Republican and he's been contributing to McCain's campaign.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
So I think Magnum PI has got to go.
Okay. All righty.
Third thing is, I don't know if you watched Democracy Now's interview with Obama's campaign advisor, Cass Sunstein, but he really makes no excuses for not prosecuting Bush for war crimes and high crimes and this type of thing.
Yeah. Cass Sunstein is a brilliant writer, by the way. His books on FDR and the New Deal and are just absolutely extraordinary. And he's been on this program a couple of times. Interesting. Thank you, Weldon. Thanks a lot for the call. We got just a minute before a break here. Mark in Las Vegas, Nevada. Nevada.
Yes, that's right. Well, then, no, I don't get quite so upset. The Spanish, which is, of course, what the name is, means basically snow-capped. And Nevada is closer to the Spanish pronunciation.
Okay.
Yeah,
but it's okay either way.
Because
we're tight on time here.
Yeah, okay, real quick. The Fairness Doctrine, it doesn't exclude somebody from saying something. It just means that they can be called on it if it's not factual. I wish we'd get away from the use of the term bias, because I'm not so much interested in bias. Everything is going to have some kind of bias a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to know if it's factually based. And what happens on the right wing, we could hear it in your last hour, is that they just yell louder and try to yell over you, and they're not listening.
Yeah, good point, Mark. But ultimately the problem for those in news, and having spent 7 years as a news person, as a reporter, and as a news anchor in a radio station in Lansing, Michigan, I'll tell you, there is always some sort of an editorial process that you go through, just deciding what to cover. And that often reflects some sort of a worldview, and it's just impossible to get away from. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, 866-303-2270, AirAmerica.com. Sarah in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Sarah.
Oh, hey. This is about that Motley guy, and it's what's it to him if these liberal networks are losing ratings? I mean, I would imagine that he'd be pretty ecstatic about that.
Yeah, you'd think so. There does seem to be a certain internal inconsistency to his logic. Sarah, thank you for your comment. Well said. Deb in Kenmore, New York. Hey, Deb.
Hi. I remember when McCain a couple months ago was harping on Obama going to the Middle East, and now he's eating his words. there was this talking point.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, in fact, he even had a clock up on his website. How many days
right.
since Obama's been to Iraq?
Boy, is it hitting him in the back side now.
Yep.
Also, Bush about a trial. I think he should be in the same court that Saddam was in, and let the court system there decide what his fate is.
Wow, you know, they hung Saddam in such a fashion that it literally ripped his head off. His head went rolling across the floor.
Well, if that's the decision they want to give, that's what he would. That would be his justice, you know.
Yeah,
and secondly,
plus they killed both his children, you know, and put them out on public display.
That's right. Yeah, I remember before the war, Janine Garofalo said 100,000 people would die if this war came, and her number was, everybody laughed at her, and her number was actually very small compared to how many people that actually did die.
Yeah, absolutely, Deb. Thank you very much. Well said, Jenny in Holt, Michigan. Hey, Jenny.
It's Jerry.
Oh, Jerry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tom. Well, first of all, Phil Graham was right. Partly. He was half right. The U.S. is full of Republicans that are whiners. I mean, your last guest on there, I mean, the Republicans have been great at propaganda, innuendo, and lies. And his obsession with the Obama's coverage, well, now he's complaining because he's getting a little positive coverage. But right. for so long, yes, Obama was under the spotlight, but it was all negative, and all it did was reinforce the questions about his religion.
Right, it was Reverend Wright and this and that and the other thing.
That's right, and they played it over and over, and it was so good for their message.
Yeah. They were loving that, and now they're lumping all that in with the stats on how much coverage Obama has
exactly,
gotten.
Exactly. And it was all negative before. Now they didn't mind that. You didn't see this guy come on and complain then.
Right.
It's now that he's overseas and getting some positive coverage. And the woman that said, that just was on and said, you know, be careful what you wish for, because with McCain, he's gotten, you know, now it's good coverage, and now he's sorry that he started this thing.
Yeah,
but,
I think you're absolutely right, Jerry, and well said. Paula in Mexico. Hey, Paula.
Hello, Tom. I listen to you every day.
Well, thank you.
And I'm actually here to escape the news, but I never miss you.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to thank you so much for the rant that you just gave a few minutes ago about Karadzic and how you compared his crimes to the war crimes of G.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that you remind people over and over about what we have done to the country. It just makes me crazy when all we talk about is the military that we lose, which is horrible. But what we've done to the people is like a million times more than what we've lost.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a tragedy of mind-boggling proportions.
Mind-boggling. And when you just kind of laid it out about the refugees and everything, I'm so grateful to you. I have something at stake because my husband is from Iran, and he is an American citizen by choice. And I will never forget how proud he was to vote the first time. And he's campaigned for Obama. He's knocked on doors. And the disillusion of what our country is doing and what Congress has allowed it to do is really disheartening.
Yeah. Well, it is to most, I think, Americans, and it is all around the world. And that's the reason why Obama is being treated like a rock star. And, Paula, thank you very much for the call. And it's because the people all around the world are saying, thank God, you know, finally a guy who actually, you know, understands international issues, can speak in complete sentences, you know, really cares, I mean, et cetera. Evan in North Carolina. Hey, Evan.
Hello, sir. Let's see. As far as the issue of the rape rooms and that sort of the rapes that were authorized by the I can't pronounce his name. The
gentleman. I think I'm mispronouncing it, but I've always called him Radovan Karadzic. The woman who just a moment ago pronounced it differently, Karadzic.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. We had rape rooms authorized apparently by Bush's inner circle in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. Sexual assault, rape, and that sort of thing was integral to their interrogation program.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Evan. Thank you for pointing that out. William in Portland, Oregon, listening to KPOJ. Hey, William.
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
I think two things. One, I think if he's not given a life sentence in an Iraqi prison,
he being Bush,
George Bush,
mm-hmm.
I think that he should be forced to produce a lifelong documentary for the rest of his life, interviewing every single person he's affected in Iraq.
Mm.
He should have to sit down and hear all the stories, see all the pictures, meet all the people that all his crimes have affected.
Yeah.
And that should be for the rest of his life.
Yeah, an interesting concept, William. Thank you. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean, got a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Okay, hey, Tom. Hey, with over 150,000 radio stations and over 5,000 TV stations available to us via high-speed internet, we really don't need the internet, mainstream media anymore. I mean, we can control them, and we don't realize it because we've been so dependent on them for all these years.
Yeah, well, this is actually, it's very interesting how things are changing. I mean, we look at, for example, on our show, I mean, just the number of people who are streaming this show is mind-boggling. I mean,
that's how I found you 6 years ago. I got sick of the Indiana, Republican media, and I said, screw this. I'm going on the internet. I'm going to see what I can find.
Yeah, you used to listen to us on radiopower.org. And
IE America.
Yeah, there you go. Sean, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call, though. It's always great to hear from you, and I wish you well. Michael Waldman coming up, the former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. Some ideas about how to reform America. And then back to our conversation. Stick with me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. How do we restore some semblance of sanity to the political processes of this nation? Michael Waldman, during his time in the Clinton administration, wrote or edited nearly 2,000 speeches, including 4 State of the Union addresses, 2 inaugural speeches. He was special assistant to the president for policy coordination, focusing on campaign finance reform, one of the center's signature issues. Drafted the administration's public financing proposal. His previous book, POTUS Speaks. His current book, A Return to Common Sense, 7 Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. And he works at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, brennancenter.org, the website. Michael Waldman, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Glad to have you with us. What are the 7 ways to seven bold ways to revitalize democracy?
You should have seen the ones that we left on the cutting room floor because they weren't bold. The theme of the book is this. It borrows the title from, of course, Tom Paine's Common Sense,
right,
which had the audacious idea for its time and now as well that government really only is legitimate if it is based on the consent of the people. And we've been struggling to get there, for 2 or more centuries. And we have, despite the thrilling surge in voting, even in contributing on the internet, we have systems of democracy that are ramshackle and rife with disenfranchisement. And so we set out 7 steps that would help renew democracy in America, starting with voting. Voting is the heart of our democracy, any democracy, but it's no secret that the way we cast and count votes in this country is leaves a lot of people out, is subject to all kinds of partisan manipulation. The first idea is really something that is done in other countries that are democracies, which is universal voter registration.
Right.
Former Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter looked at our voter registration systems and concluded that they're one of the reasons we have some of the lowest voter turnout rates in the world are that we have some of the strictest and worst voter registration rules in the world.
Well, and it goes even beyond that. Mark Crispin Miller just forwarded me an email from the Michigan Republican Party. Poll challenger training to be online this year. Ever thought about volunteering as an Election Day poll challenger but couldn't make it to the training seminar? Well, you're in luck. This month, the Michigan Republican Party will be introducing 7 online training videos which will cover the information poll challengers need to know before they arrive at the polls. These videos will cover a wide range of topics from the voting process itself to the role of Election Day lawyers. Please sign up today on the volunteer section of the Michigan Republicans website. They are training people to exclude people from voting.
Well, and imagine that as opposed to training people to help people vote, which I think all political parties ought to do.
But see, here's the problem.
The Republicans have made it clear this year. You know, a lot of these democracy issues don't fall down on partisan lines. But unfortunately, the Republicans have made it clear that they've got a strategy on voter ID and all other kinds of things of trying to restrict a lot of people's rights to vote.
And Michael Waldman, this is not new. I believe it's a 15, it might be a 16-year-old clip of Paul Weyrich. You know who Paul Weyrich is?
Sure.
The major Republican strategist, a major player in Republican campaigns from Reagan to Bush. Here he is, just a short clip, speaking to a group of Republican activists in a church.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So the Republican campaign for the better part of two decades that Weyrich has been out there pushing this thing has been to drive down the number of voters. How do you fight it against that?
Well, number one, you got to stop the disenfranchisement where you see it. That's why groups like the Brennan Center and others are out there all over the country bringing lawsuits, working with local officials. We have a study that just came out yesterday that was the lead story in USA Today about how 8 years after the butterfly ballot in Florida helped create that fiasco, and we spent $3 billion moving to electronic voting, the one thing everybody forgot about was ballot design, that hundreds of thousands of votes are lost every year due to bad ballot design, overwhelmingly elderly and less educated voters. So we got to fight those fights all the time, and up until the election especially, it's going to be a big fight. But yeah, we need to not just say what do we need to do to make this election fair right now, but what can we do to tap the potential for change in 2009 and beyond. So,
right. So in the 4 minutes,
legislation for universal voter registration, legislation
right.
to create public financing for congressional and fix the presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
Move to national popular vote, which I know your listeners know about, to bypass the Electoral College, restoring checks and balances between the executive branch and Congress. Things like that have to be part of the governing agenda of whoever's president next. And it's really up to all of us to insist, that these candidates talk about it. You've got in Obama, obviously, a candidate running on the theme of change. You've got in McCain somebody running on the theme of reform, and way in the past, not so much recently, but he actually was quite a reform force in a lot of these things. I like to see these candidates competing to talk about what they're going to do to renew democracy.
You mean like when he was one of the Keating Five?
Well, he felt
he talks a good line. Let's acknowledge. I'll acknowledge that. But we're talking with Michael Waldman, his new book, A Return to Common Sense, 7 Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy. Michael, I just played you that clip of Weyrich, the Republican position, and now the Republicans in Michigan are aggressively, they're going to stop everybody at the polls and try to turn away anybody who looks like they might be Democratic. On the Democratic side, we have over 300 communities in the United States now that have instant runoff voting, which is a way that allows multiple parties to participate and democratizes, small d, democratizes the voting process. And yet the Democratic Party is a consistent opponent of instant runoff voting. This is working very well in Australia and New Zealand. We're, along with Australia and New Zealand, we are one of only 7 countries in the world that doesn't have proportional representation. They solved that problem with IRV or their variations on it. How do we change the perspective of even the Democratic Party for this kind of thing?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think that finding ways to be creative, to keep pushing the major parties, is something we've all got to do. And instant runoff voting and proportional representation are things, on the one hand, they're very they're intriguing, and if people really understood them, they might be very appealing. But they're so out of the experience of most Americans who are used to voting for
you know, a winner and a loser. And
well, everybody in San Francisco seems to be happy with it. I mean, it's that's a pretty major city.
Well, the, what I was going to say is I think one thing that a lot of parties, a lot of states have looked at, that I live in New York State, and it actually has worked well in New York State, is real fusion voting, which is, in New York State, for example, you can have, in most places, a minor party cannot endorse the same candidate that a major party has already endorsed.
Right.
And so voters are given this choice of, you know, quote, throwing your vote away or not.
Right.
In New York, the Working Families Party and the Conservative Party and the Right to Life Party, they can cross endorse major party candidates.
Right.
And it's a way of giving people a chance to express a vote, it gives them some power, and it also creates a constituency for things, for more creative reforms.
Right.
My view as a strategy matter is, it's bad enough that we've got state legislatures trying to pass proof of citizenship requirements for people voting. Mm-hmm. It's bad enough that we've got three times the numbers of lobbyists in Washington right now, and that for all the excitement over Obama raising so much money through the internet, through small contributions, which is really a wonderful step forward, you know, the fact is Congress raises its money the old-fashioned way, overwhelmingly from K Street.
Right.
So, you know,
the GOP just came up with $200 million for John McCain at the same time that Obama raised $50 million. I mean, it's going to take Obama three more $50 million months just to match what the GOP just gave McCain.
Yeah. So I think I think finding a way to resuscitate public financing has got to be a central progressive goal now, as it has been for a long time. I think that if we don't, and whatever major changes that people want to see, whether it's healthcare or climate change or anything else, there's a real risk that all this progressive energy that we see out there now is going to run smack into a broken political system.
Yeah.
That it makes it hard for anything to happen.
A Return to Common Sense, Michael Waldman's book, Seven Bold Ways to Revitalize Democracy, with the Brennan Center for Justice, brennancenter.org, the website. Michael, thank you so much for dropping by today.
My pleasure.
Fascinating conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. Back to your calls right after this.
This is Tom Hartman.
Past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at teamster.org, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, our websites. And get the right mouse here, Judy in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Judy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was just going to make a comment what I think should happen to Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I think he should confront all the families that lost a loved one in the war and explain why. And then we should put him in his wonderful Guantanamo Bay and experience that.
Send him to, okay, Judy. I think that is a great suggestion. And let's remember why back in 1999 George Bush said he was going to invade Iraq.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
So here's George Bush telling his biographer, the guy who wrote A Charge to Keep, George Bush's autobiography, in 1999, that he would invade Iraq because it would get him political power. Earl in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Earl.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. I'll get better. What's up?
The suggestion on George Bush, you know, I believe it was Lee at the top, before the top of the hour suggested that he has to listen to the victims of Iraq of his policies for the rest of his life. To the normal person, that would be a punishment, but I don't believe that it would be effective with George Bush because I believe the man lacks a conscience. I believe he's sociopathic. I think a more fitting punishment might be to strip him of his personal wealth and make him live in the world that he's created.
Yeah, I think you're right. Unfortunately, thank you, Chris, San Francisco. Hey, Chris.
In San Francisco, and proud member of Pile Drivers Local 34 in Oakland.
Good on you.
Right on. Hey, writing rules, right on. But I'm calling about. Calling about your last segment when you were talking to that author, I forgot his name, and you played
Michael
that
Waldman.
Clip. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And you played that clip of that that neo-con.
Paul Weyrich, the one of the probably top five Republican strategists out of the last 20 years.
You know what? He's just a neo-con to me. I don't even need to know his name. But talking in that church, and you played the clip, and you came back, and you asked Michael, "What can we do about this?" Tell me, the guy gives you your own ammunition. You take that clip and you play it. You play it in every district, in every state where people have been disenfranchised. You play it in Cleveland where they stood out in the rain for hours. You play it in New Orleans where people were disenfranchised, not only from the voting process, but from their own government when they needed it most.
Yep.
You play it over and over again, and you let people know that this is what they're up against. And you let people know, and you empower them. You let them know you can change this. Because all the people that I've talked to that say, "Oh, I don't know, my vote doesn't count," or whatever, if nothing else will get them angry, or nothing else will get them to the polls, at least get them angry. Say, "Well, you know what? Maybe you should go vote and take and at least let them make it personal then, and let them feel like they're getting back and that they have a stake in this."
Yep.
Because and show them what's at stake.
Very well said, Chris. Thank you very much. Yeah, and it's not enough to vote, just to vote this year. You need to show up and participate. Bob in San Francisco. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Now, I'd like to, in honor of the arrest of Radzovic, whatever, analogize the Anbar awakening to the Kosovo War.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases, there were action on the ground that we were way remote from, and 30 days of bombing did no good to stop the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo until we armed the Albanians and then we could have them smoke out the Serb, and we could go after them. And we could send a surge to Iraq, but would they just sit in the green zone? You know, we had to arm the Sunnis, and Rumsfeld probably decided on it. He probably adopted the Biden plan sub silencio and said, it's going to be partition, but let's make sure our Sunnis are able to take part of it, and we'll be with them when it's all over, or maybe the Kurds, or both.
Or all three. I mean, what you're going to see, I think, is a tripartite government. I think it is going to be the Biden plan, only by a brutal means rather than a political means, as Joe Biden had suggested. I think we're already three-quarters of the way there, if not, you know, nine-tenths of the way there, and of partitioning of the country and ethnic cleansing, essentially, although Joe Biden certainly wouldn't characterize his plan as ethnic cleansing. And you're going to see a ruling elite of all three groups. They're going to come together over the money for the oil because there's so much oil there. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. That's ultimately going to be the thing that's going to pull people together in Iraq. Hopefully, you know, as bizarre as that sounds, because if it's not that, it's going to be religion, and that could end up being very toxic. 866-303-2270, our number, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270. We live in the land of plenty.
things aren't plenty anymore. Like the water from our sink, they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the old song. Look what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the sea, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only ours to borrow. Let's save some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down.
What a fine notion. 35 minutes past the hour. Strange stuff going on over at Fox News. Or Fixed Noise. No, maybe they're crazy. Yeah, probably. Fox News' Brett Baer says on screen, the high price of gas may be costing your kids some of their education. And the chyron underneath has the word education spelled E-D-U-C-T-A-I-O-N. I can't even pronounce that as a word. So, yeah, apparently they need a little education over at Fox News. By the way, just discovered, actually I didn't discover, the folks in the chat room told me about it. This really cool website, you got to check this out. Send Carl Rove to jail. And don't forget, Carl is spelled with a K. Send KarlRoveToJail.com. Send KarlRoveToJail.com. It's great. It's, so, anyhow, 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Doug in Hamel, is it Hamel, California?
Hamel there, Tom, Hamel.
Hamel. Hey, Doug, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just fine. You wanted to disagree with me about voting?
Right, because did you know in 2005 the U.S. Government Accountability Office found that up to 3% of the 3,000 individuals called for jury duty from voter registration rolls over a two-year period in just one U.S. district court were not U.S. citizens, and that's 3% of the registered voters. That was in Florida. Now, you put on Michael Walden for one side of the story. You shouldn't get the author of The Threat of Non-Citizen Voting, Hans A. von Spalsky from the Heritage Foundation. Get him on the air.
I've had him on the show before. And here's the point. The reason why you've got those non-citizens who are on the voting rolls is because when you get your driver's license, you're registered to vote. And, you know, which I think is broadly a fine thing, but we've got to come to some kind of a conclusion here in the United States about what, you know, whether or not we're going to allow people who are not citizens to have driver's licenses or not. Because I guarantee you, Doug, you know, as hysterical as everybody is about people who are not citizens being registered to vote, they're not showing up at the polls.
There is no evidence that they're showing up at the polls. There is. This shows that there is evidence, and you're absolutely wrong. You need to go.
No, this shows that they got a driver's license, which caused them to get registered to vote and caused them to be registered for jury duty. It doesn't mean that they are showing up to vote. People, by and large, who are not citizens are not willing to go into a place, to go into an environment where they know they're going to be challenged, where they could be put in jail. It ain't happening. I mean, if there was any evidence of it, it would be being trumpeted by Lou Dobbs and company.
It's already been shown on Lou Dobbs. He's talked to him. You need to talk to him. 8 out of the 19 Saudi terrorists, the 9/11, registered to vote. Mario,
in other words,
also,
got driver's licenses and the state automatically registered them.
Okay, well, they registered to vote and they showed.
See, this raises the which is something the conservatives are making sure changes. But the point is that doesn't mean that they voted. I doubt that any of those guys voted.
Get Hans on and have him talk about this so your audience gets the other side. You're saying since it's so hard to determine U.S. citizenship that we should just not do it. We should just let everybody vote. That's what you're putting out to your audience. Do you know that?
Well, let me think about that for a second. I guess I am saying that.
That's what you're saying. So, see, this is what bothers me.
And my sense of it is that if, A, we had reasonable labor policies in the United States where we said only Only people who are citizens of the United States can work in the United States, as you will find in other countries. I lived in Germany for a year. I had to spend 3 months getting a permit to work in Germany during that year that I was there. It was incredible. To open a checking account in Germany, I had to prove that I was there legally. It is very, very, extremely difficult in virtually any other country in the world, including Mexico, for that matter, to get a permit to work or to engage in commerce without proving citizenship. And I think that in the United States, if we were simply to say you have to be a citizen to work, that, you know, that would be a great thing. And because what it would do is it would, number one, drive forward the discussion and the debate on what's an appropriate immigration policy, because obviously our immigration policy is broken. And number two, it would stop corporations from having workers who they know are illegal and therefore can exploit by having people who are basically terrified of being turned over to ICE, and therefore they can pay them lousy wages or in some cases no wages at all and have lousy working conditions. We've got sweatshops and essentially near slave labor going on in the United States because we're not enforcing that simple rule. And, you know, in that regard and on that issue, you know, I agree with Lou Dobbs.
Now, Tom, you just mentioned something about our immigration policy is broken. I've listened to you many times on the air.
Yeah.
Is it your policy as a progressive to continue the immigration levels that they are, even during a recession?
Well, our immigration level right now is between 800,000 and 900,000 a year is the number of people that we legally let into the United States as immigrants. In addition to that, there's about 1 million people a year, I believe, that are coming in on the visa system. I may be wrong on that second number. I think that we need to re-examine the whole visa system thing. If we don't have enough trained engineers in the United States, we shouldn't be importing them from India. We should be giving people free access to college and investing in that human capital so that when they become engineers, as Americans, they're paying taxes in the United States and they're not sending their income back to India. You know, number one. Well, I guess that's the beginning and the end of the whole thing.
Well, you didn't answer the question.
Okay, what was the question again?
The question is, would be your policy, if you were the president of the United States as a progressive, would you continue to keep the immigration levels at the current levels even during a recession?
I think, the problem with regard to the recession is not, it's to the extent that immigration plays any role in it. First of all, it's a relatively small role, but I acknowledge that it does play a role in it. In fact, I wrote a chapter about it in my book, Screwed. You can read it about David Ricardo in 1817 wrote his Iron Law of Labor, that when the supply of labor is equal to the demand for labor, the cost of labor will crash down to a subsistence level. In other words, you wipe out the middle class. And that's what the conservatives want, and that's what's been happening. But the problem isn't the roughly 2 million people a year who are coming into this country legally. The problem is the much larger number of people who are coming into this country illegally.
So you're saying, you just keep the levels as are.
No, I'm not. I'm suggesting that what we need to do is twofold. Number one, we need to make it almost impossible for somebody to work here illegally. And then number two, we need to sit down as a nation and say, okay, that done, what is the number of people that we want to bring into the United States for two different reasons? One being compassion. I mean, we do allow refugees in this country. Particularly, we should be allowing Iraqi refugees. We have a total of, I think, throughout the entire 7 years that we've been fighting this war, I think we've allowed about 5,000 Iraqis into this country. That's absurd and obscene, given the refugee crisis we've created there. So number one. And number two, are there areas of labor where we actually do need to import people? I think that there should be very, very few of those, frankly. And if we identify a large number of those are areas where we should be educating people. If we don't have enough nurses, instead of importing them from the Philippines, let's open more nursing schools. If we don't have enough engineers, let's have more engineering schools. So no, I don't think that the current numbers of legal immigrants are frankly high enough. And I think the current numbers of illegal immigrants are way too high.
Is it a progressive policy to put commerce before country?
No, absolutely not. And I'm not sure that there is a progressive position. I think that I'm articulating the progressive position on this. The position that I'm articulating is the one that the unions starting in the 1880s were putting forward when the railroads, in order to bust the unions, were importing labor from China. And they were bringing Chinese in to work on the railroads in the 1880s in the West, and the labor unions successfully passed actually what turned out to be a very racist law in 1880, making it illegal to import Chinese into the United States. But you know, the point is that there's a long history of labor. You know, Cesar Chavez marched from Central California down to the Mexican border to protest the illegal immigration, the illegal people coming into the United States illegally and working in the fields and being used by the owners of the agricultural businesses to bust his union, the Farm Workers Union. So I would suggest that this is the progressive position, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of progressives and Democrats who totally disagree with me and think that we should simply, you know, legalize everybody who's in the country and throw the doors open. And I think that that's wrong. I don't think any other country in the world does that. There is no rationality to that, and I think it's a mistake for the United States.
My last comment. Do you know who Mario Alberto Martinez is?
No, I don't.
He, in 1994, he assassinated the presidential candidate, Luis Gallego Colosio. And he registered to vote twice and voted twice in California. So you got to get this author on from the Heritage Foundation again.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Doug, it's the exception that proves the rule. I am far more concerned about the fact that in Florida, 20,000, a minimum of 20,000, maybe as many as 90,000 African-Americans were forbidden from voting in the 2000 election because of Republican election fraud by knocking them off the rolls by saying that they were felons or that they weren't citizens. And if 100 or 200 or 300 illegal immigrants voted in Florida, I don't frankly give a damn. The numbers are so small, they're irrelevant. We need to be having more people voting, and frankly, we need to balance our proportion of labor to the demand for labor in the United States. I think they're two completely different issues. Doug, thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Fuzzy puppets, old TV shows, and snow.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Good day. Well, the Congressional Budget Office director said that if there is a federal bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, it could cost taxpayers as much as $25 billion, that's with a B, dollars. The director said he sent an open letter to members of Congress, and he said that there is better than a 50% chance that it won't be necessary, either as a loan or through stock purchase, but that it was very important. And then Treasury Secretary Paulson today actually said that Congress needs to act quickly because continued operation of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are central to the speed with which we emerge from this housing correction. Notice that he called it a housing correction.
Yeah, but he's right, and I think that we should buy back all of the stock and renationalize Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and put them back as they originally were designed to be. By the way, $25 billion divided into 115 million working families in America, $217 per family. So that's our cost of the bailout if we do it as a bailout. On the other hand, if we did it, I don't know what the cost would be to buy all of the outstanding stock in Freddie and Fannie. I'm guessing it would probably be about four times that.
At least, sure.
Yeah, that would probably be about $1,000 per family. But even that, I think, ultimately would be a good thing. Because just like with our banking system, this is our first hour. We were talking about the Green Party's proposal to nationalize the Fed, to buy back the Fed from the banks and the stockholders, put it under the Treasury, and have our government actually issue our own currency and regulate the value of the currency like the Constitution says we're supposed to do. And I think that we should be doing the same thing with Freddie and Fannie because they're there to facilitate to backstop banks and individuals in time of difficulty.
Well, Paulson, this is part of his traveling roadshow to calm fears on the market. He gave it at at the New York Public Library today. He also said that the overall banking industry is sound. He said last week our markets witnessed failure of IndyMac Bank, which was the third largest bank failure in U.S. history. He said it's worthy of attention, but he said as large as IndyMac is, it represents 0.2% of total banking industry assets. Now, I've been talking to some people I met a guy that works with a lot of different family offices, sort of advising them financially. These are wealthy people that sort of have their own, you know, like the Rockefeller brothers, et cetera. And
right.
People, some of these wealthy families have left cash in accounts in more than $100,000. And they're advising people open up different accounts because each account is insured for $100,000. So
right.
If anybody's lucky enough to have $100,000 in the bank, if you have more of it, open a second account.
Right, yeah. We've Robbie Batra, the economist from Southern Methodist University and the author of Greenspan's Fraud, was making that advice on this program. And I think that the truly wealthy in America are simply opening accounts in Switzerland or Liechtenstein or some European country where they can put their money in euros. And number one, they get it out of the U.S. banking system. And number two, they get it out of the dollar because the dollar is collapsing as fast as our banking system is.
Right. What people have to be very careful of, and again, this is from somebody I talked to at the IRS a couple weeks ago, is that if you don't think that the IRS is, what you can do is you can move money across the oceans, et cetera. What you can't do is not declare it.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about evading income taxes. I'm simply talking about, getting out from underneath the dollar and the U.S. banking system. I know at least one person with a lot of money who's moved all his money to France.
Wow. Okay, there was a U.S. Senate hearing today on climate science. And Senator Inhofe, all he would say, and he had brought up some guy who is supposedly a major atmospheric scientist. Actually, I think he's a former NASA guy. And he said that there is no conclusive physical links between global warming and observable hurricane frequency and intensity. And then he also said that in peer-reviewed studies that climate change, this Roy Spencer said, that warming we have experienced in the last 100 years is mainly natural. So they're trying to parade people before the committees to do that.
Yeah, this is the anti-Al Gore roadshow.
Exactly. McCain's folks came out today. They have a new web video. It's called Obama Love. And I know you were earlier talking in the program about the media's love affair, supposedly, which there isn't, with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
But
they sure didn't love him when they were talking about Reverend Wright, I'll tell you.
Yeah, well, exactly. And they are now having on McCain's website, vote for your favorite song for Obama Love. So they're trying to make it participatory on their website.
Yeah, yeah. McCain shouldn't talk. I mean, this is a guy who has courted the media his entire career. He's basically made his senatorial career all about, having the media. In the 2000s, the media was just agog for John McCain,
right.
For example.
I thought he was great. He would sit down and actually talk to us.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
a breath of fresh air. Senator Obama is in Jordan, had a press conference today. He said that his goal was to no longer have U.S. troops engaged in combat operations in Iraq, and he said that U.S. efforts should focus more on Afghanistan and on efforts to help Pakistan deal with a growing number of terrorists. He called Afghanistan the central front in the war on terror, and called conditions in that country perilous and urgent. He said, we must act now to reverse the deteriorating situation.
Yeah, and he's right. Okay, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And Ellen, please call Louise.
I am going to. I heard you loud and clear.
Okay, thank you very much. Good talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of cnsnews.com. Guaranteed government? Is it the government's role to guarantee us certain material benefits in addition to preserving our basic human rights? Plus, Dr. Dagmar Herzog drops by to talk about sex in crisis, the new sexual revolution, and the future of American politics. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.